And he is very well dressed, I must say.
Hey.
Thank you. Hello, everybody. My name is Charlie, and I am an alcoholic. Let me get the little timer started here so I know I don't go too far over. I am notorious for going over. Thank you guys so much for asking us to come up and share. Thank you to all the speakers that spoke prior. And this has been a wonderful roundup. You guys have a really nice thing going on here. If you are new to Alcoholics Anonymous, or undercover new because you just didn't want to say anything, welcome. Welcome to the largest fellowship in the world. This is just one meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in the state of California that's going on right now, and there's probably 1,000 meetings going on in the state of California, not to mention the rest of the country. We don't sign membership cards in AA. We're anonymous. But Alcoholics Anonymous is worldwide, 180-something countries, and we've just passed translating the big book into its 100th different language, which I think was Haitian Creole, if I read that correct. 100 languages and dialects, over 180 countries worldwide. There's probably, by our best estimate, 2 million members, sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. So if you are brand new to AA, I will guarantee you that you have at least two things in common with those 2 million other people. One of them is that nobody got here because they were on a winning streak. And the other thing is no one ever aspired to be a member of this program. Nobody ever grew up saying, "Little Johnny, what do you want to do when you grow up? This guy wants to be a firefighter. This guy wants to be a cop. What do you want to do, Johnny?" I would like to destroy every relationship I have in my life. I would like to dismantle everything good in my life. I'd like to accidentally shit my pants a couple of times and then go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Nobody has ever said that. So welcome. You are in good company here. Hold on. I say it to Angela all the time. I don't know why I agree to do this. Because it is nerve-wracking. Like Wayne said last night, I don't have a canned pitch. It's not like if you know what a canned pitch is. It's where you listen to a speaker and you go, "Oh my God, that guy was great." And then you listen to him at another venue, same guy, and you go, "Holy cow, he's really funny. I really like when he says this." And then you hear him a third time and you go, "I know what he's going to say next." You know, it's a canned pitch. You pop the top on the can and you get the same thing every time. And that's not what you get from me. I'm good. Thank you. I had one here. A little housekeeping thing. I am born and raised Staten Island, New York. A little bit ways from home here. And my sobriety date is the end of February of 1981. And so what that means is that this past February I have enjoyed and been blessed with 43 years of continuous and uninterrupted sobriety. I was born into a good family, hardworking people. Good, they taught us good values, and they tried to teach us good values. Hardworking parents. My dad was a New York City firefighter for 30 plus years, as was his dad, my grandfather, 30 years on the New York Fire Department, and my uncles, my cousins. It's a big New York City firefighter family. My dad worked a second job with Sears and Roebuck, and then he would work sometimes a third job with a friend of his that had a plumbing company. And he did all of that so that my mom did not have to work. My mom was home, so that any of us four kids got home from school, mom was there. They were a good family. They did try and teach us right from wrong, and they did try to every Sunday go to church. You know, here's a buck, put it in the basket. All of this worked very, very well for my sister. I am the youngest of four kids. My oldest sister, it worked extremely well for her. My oldest brother, it was interesting. He was kind of went his own way for a little while, but then kind of came around and a good, respectful, upstanding guy. My next oldest brother was the brainiac of the family. He was the one that always had his nose in a book, always. And he was the only one, or the very first one in our family to ever go to college. Then there was me. And I learned very quickly that dollar I was supposed to throw in the poor basket at church was better spent on me at Paul's Sweet Shop up in the corner. And so off I go to church, but divert off and go up to Paul's and spend an hour up there, and then go back home. And how was church? Just fine, thank you. And so it was very easy for me at a very young age to not have any kind of a connection with the concept of a God. It didn't work for me. Who was it that was saying they were an altar boy? And was looking out, I think it was that guy, Ryan from Bishop, was saying that he was an altar boy. And he's standing up and he's looking out at everybody else in the church and he's thinking that you're getting something that I'm not getting. And it was the same for me. I wasn't getting it. And so it was very easy for me to divert away. Plus, this is New York City in the 1960s and 70s. It's a very turbulent time. There was a lot of, it was just a very turbulent time. It was the height of the Vietnam War and it was on TV every night. My dad was a World War II veteran. And my oldest brother, who was slated to be drafted, absolutely did not want to go. And so there was a lot of tension in the house. And I tended to want to side with my older brother, who I admired very much. When you come to Alcoholics Anonymous long enough, you start to hear some commonalities, some common things. The concept of, or the unusual feeling of being separate from everyone else, being different, on the outside looking in. Bill talks about that. Bill talks about that in his very early years, and that, I think, really came to his knowledge when he was about 12 years old and his parents had split, and he was sent to live with his grandparents. And he felt very much different from everyone else. I felt the same way. And when you come to enough Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, you hear that from enough people. And so that's a commonality. I don't think it's exclusive to alcoholics. I think there's a lot of people that feel that way growing up. What is exclusive to alcoholics is how we treat that. Some people treat it by getting involved in sports. And they become a part of a team, and all of a sudden they belong. Some people find it in music. They discover their musical talent, and they discover that they have a part of a band. They are a part of a band. They're part of a group. They're part of something. And those of us, I really do believe how we find it is we take that first drink and realize, oh my God, I no longer feel separated from. I no longer feel different. The other commonality, besides this concept of feeling separate and alone, separate from everyone else, is that many of us, not all of us, but many of us, remember our very first drink. And I certainly remember my very first drink. Now, I'm going to tell you, had I spoken for you guys probably 3 months ago, I would have turned sideways and said, look at the size of this thing. I like ice cream, you know what I mean? But I cannot tell, we've been on a diet for the last couple of months, so I've shaved off a little, thank God. But I can't tell you the very first time I had ice cream. I love ice cream, but I can't tell you the very first time I ever had it. I can tell you my very first drink. I was 9 years old, man. I was 9 years old, and I was doing a book report. And I didn't want to do this book report. I absolutely did not want to do this. My mom had the doors open so that while she was in the kitchen, she could look down the hallway and make sure that I was sitting at the desk and doing what I was supposed to be doing. I absolutely did not want to do this book report because I never read the book. And that right there explains all of my years of going to school. I had never read the book, you know, just enough to get by. My brother gave me a beer, popped the top on a can and gave him, put it right down in front of me, and I drank that whole thing down, 9 years old. And although it didn't knowingly do a whole lot for me, apparently it did a whole lot for me, because I now was able to go in and tell my mom, I ain't doing that effing book report. Which was definitely the wrong thing to say to my mom, I'm just going to tell you. After the back slap. But the interesting part is that I felt compelled that I am not so insecure, I am not so introverted, I am not so fearful anymore that I could tell my mom, I ain't doing that book report. And I still remember to this day the words that she said to my brother. It was really kind of an interesting thing. She goes, why would you do that? Why would you give him that? Look at him. He's like a completely different kid. And that struck with me. That if I didn't want to be that scared, frightened little kid, I know exactly how to treat that. And so I would go from that age on, I would go into my oldest brother's room, who had a bar. This was not unusual. This is a different era. This is a different era. So my brother is 20 years old. He has a bar in his bedroom. Christmas lights and everything hanging off of it. He's got the big tower speakers and the tower stereo system. And so I would go in and I would steal from his bar. And my dad, in fact, had a bar down in the basement. Now, my dad is not an alcoholic. I do believe he came from an alcoholic household, and he may have been emotionally affected by the disease of alcoholism, but my dad's not an alcoholic. Neither of my parents had a problem like that. Like I said, minimal dysfunction growing up in our family. If alcoholism was caused by a lack of love, I should not be standing here today. They were wonderful people, but I would steal from either one of those bars, and I would go up into my brother's bedroom and put on those big, giant, knobby headphones. Remember those old things? And then I would plug in the Black Sabbath 8-track, you know? I love that. And I'd turn that stuff all the way up, you know? And you know, it's funny. Here we are. How many years, 40, 50 years later, I still listen to that music. I enjoy that music. I just do. It's in my blood. Angela looks at me, just shakes her head, you know. And so I had my very first drink when I was 9 years old. And I was a scared, insecure little kid. I had my last drink of alcohol when I was 19 years old. And I was still a scared, insecure little kid. The difference is, my life had deteriorated down so badly that by the time I was 19 years old, I didn't see any way out of it. No way out of it. I did successfully manage to navigate my way through 12 years of the New York City public school system, completely unscarred by education, and did graduate from high school. I have no memory of that graduation, none. I am a blackout drinker. I've been blacking out since I was 14 years old. And the interesting thing about my blackouts is that I would come out of my blackouts in the midst of doing something. And usually the doing something had some degree of violence attached to it. New York City at that time was a little bit of a lawless place. There was a lot of crime. There was a lot of crime. And it was kind of like murder central of the country. The year of my high school graduation, there was over 2,200 murders in New York City. It's an average of about just under six a day. not to mention all of the crimes that lead up to that. And so all of my growing up years being out and about, in which I never ever wanted the party to end, would leave me out there at all hours of the night. And when you are 15, 16, 17 years old, you can't drive because New York, you can't drive before, at that time, you couldn't drive before you were 18. So I didn't have a car. So you got to hitchhike. And you got to understand who picks up young teenage boys at 2, 3, and 4 o'clock in the morning that are hitchhiking. And so you learn to keep an open knife in your pocket. Because now you're going to get into a car that could get dicey, and be willing to use that thing. And so there was always some degree of violence in my blackouts, and I would come out later on, I would come out of blackouts and in the midst of altercations, usually with a weapon in my hand of some kind. Trying to even out the score because I don't eat when I'm drinking. Skinnier than skinny. I'm as tall as I am now, and I was 125 pounds when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I am not prison material. And so I come out of these blackouts. My very first blackout that I came out of that I have any memory of coming out of, I was swinging a baseball bat trying to hit some guy in the head. And I couldn't understand why I couldn't hit him. I was 14 years old, and he was the security guard in the cemetery that was all of about 10 minutes from my house. It was a beautiful cemetery, 118 acres, gorgeous, gorgeous place, with 25 separate acres that belonged to the Vanderbilt family. I was 14 years old, and we used to mess with the security guard up there. And that's who was on the other side of the chain link fence that I was trying to whack with the baseball bat and couldn't figure out why I couldn't hit him. And my blackout ended with all of these other guys that are around me going, calm down, you know? And so many of my blackouts ended that way, with people looking at me going, calm down. I went to work in that cemetery when I was 15 years old, pushing a lawnmower. And I can tell you, I didn't draw a sober breath for years leading up to my age of 19. So all through high school, stoned every day, drunk every day, and drinking in bars that night. When I was 15, I went to work in that cemetery, and I met a gravedigger who was also a bouncer in a bar at night. And so in those years, if the bars even carded you, which most of them did not, they didn't care. If you had the money to spend and you were not going to cause a scene, you could drink in those bars. And so I would. I would close the bar at 2 o'clock in the morning at 15, 16 years old and try and navigate my way home. Feeling so incredibly alone. I guess that's probably the best way I could describe the last several years of my drinking, was just terribly alone. I have to apologize because I do feel a little bit of discombobulation up here, trying to keep the timeline going correctly.
No worries.
Yeah. And so my thinking, my brain, is not piecing things together correctly. I can't function out there. I'm drunk every day. Every single day, and it's like what was said last night. It was the power to take me away from me and let me be free finally. There was an event. My parents, like I said, good values. Charlie, you want a car? You better get a job. Well, I had the job, and I saved the money, and I bought a car. It had one color when I bought it. It was a 1969 Camaro. Love that. It was one color when I bought it. It was seven different colors when I got rid of it. I acquired things. I acquired things. I acquired weapons. I acquired, what can you steal from a cemetery? I had a human femur hanging from the rearview mirror of my car, and it was adorned with leather straps and feathers, and the ultimate plan for that thing was to bore a hole in it and plug off the bottom and turn it into a bong, but that didn't happen. But people would get in my car, or people would be around my car, and they would go, "What is that?" And, you know, and so hence nobody's driving with me. I went down in one of the highlighted things. There was a lot of highlighted events that led me to believe that I'm insane. I spent lots of nights alone in a place called Great Kills Park. Great Kills Park is a lot of cattails, really tall cattails, and dirt roads that would snake their way through that until it would eventually lead you over to the harbor, the bay. And so I would make my way down through Great Kills Park. And by this time, I have turned my back so far from anything that is normal. I'm working with all these guys in the cemetery, and they're brutal. I don't know if any of you guys, I'm sure there's people here that can probably relate to this, that you work with a bunch of guys. Like when I'm talking to Bakersfield, I talk about the oil wells, the oil factories, the guys that work out in the oil fields. They're roughnecks. Everything is fair game to be made fun of. Everything. Gravediggers are the same way. Make fun of everything. Exploit any weakness you got. And so I would go to work in the morning, just barely get there with a cup of coffee, of 7-Eleven coffee, like this, sitting at the table. And they would comment on that. Like, "You better slow down on the booze, kid. Look at you. You got the shakes." And then they would exploit any weakness that they could find in you. And holy cow, I'm hungover, and I can't take a solid crap to save my life. And I'm just, I'm a gravedigger, and I'm not doing the job right. I don't know how you screw up being a gravedigger. We only go in one direction, but, you know, I'm not doing a good job. And so it was difficult mornings, hungover, let me tell you. And then as soon as lunchtime came along, I would go out and I would drink my lunch. And now all of a sudden I have the courage to come back and confront them and I'm ready to fight. And then 4:30 would, and so needless to say, these guys hated me. They hated me and I hated them. 4:30 comes along, you get out of work, I go straight down to the King's Row. And me and Joey the bartender would start doing kamikaze shots until people started coming in. Then the free drinking ends, and then I'm drinking Jack Daniels all night. The bar closes. In the blink of an eye, the bar is closing at 2 o'clock in the morning, but I ain't done, man. I get in my car and I drive. I want to drive all around Staten Island, and I'm not doing that very well, hence the reason why the car had seven different colors. Your car got damaged a lot. Go down those short, little, narrow New York City streets and just bounce my way off of everything. Just, I did a lot of damage out there. I did a lot of damage to people's property. I did a lot of damage to them emotionally. I would get into conflicts on street corners with people, and the weapons would come out, and I purposely scared people, purposely. I would go out at 2-3 o'clock in the morning. You know what happens at 3 o'clock in the morning in New York? The police change shift. And the mafia's out. That's who's out at 3 o'clock in the morning in New York City at that time. And they got real guns. I mean, I got a gun, but my gun malfunctions. They got real guns, you know. And how was it that I did not run into somebody that I just put a bullet in my head and be done with it? I have no idea. The grace of God, the protection of God. Why? I didn't know. I really didn't know. Let me just fast forward here. I'm spending an awful lot of time on this drinking thing. Fast forward to August of 1980. I went to a concert in a park, and they did this. They would set up a makeshift stage, little trailer, get towed behind a vehicle, generators are going so the guitars are going. There's loud music, and probably 1,000 kids in this park. Everybody's there to listen to these bands. And the last thing I remember, after I picked up these girls hitchhiking, and we smoked what they had, and we all drank what I had, my last memory was sitting on the hood of this car with my bottle of Jack Daniels, listening to the band. My next memory is about 6 hours later, and I'm trying to get the hell out of some basement apartment to go home. The sun's coming up. And that's my only memory of that night. And that was a Saturday night. Sunday comes and goes, and I do what I do. Monday comes along, and there I am, sitting, get to work, my cup of coffee, shakes, hungover. And these guys start asking me a bunch of questions. What'd you do this weekend? Went to the park. Oh, really? What'd you do while you were there? And they want to play 20 questions with me about this, where was I and what was I doing? And so finally, I just get fed up, and I go, why? And they took a copy of the Staten Island Advance newspaper, and they spun it around and slid it across the table to me, and there's a police composite sketch on the front of that paper, and they're looking for a young guy who was wearing a red bandana, had a cheesy mustache, looks exactly like me. And the story is that a 15-year-old girl had gotten sexually assaulted in the woods and stabbed to death brutally. And this is the guy that they're looking for, because people had seen her go off into the woods with this guy. And I have no memory of that night. And I know what my blackouts are. I know the violence that's attached to my blackouts. And I know my thinking at that time. It's not clear. It's very skewed. It's very dark. Very, very dark. That femur that was hanging from my rearview mirror, not the only bone in my car, I'm just going to tell you, okay? I had a bunch of them in the trunk. I don't know why. I don't know why. Why do drunks do the things that they do? You know what I mean? I don't know. And so I spent 12 days driving around Staten Island, and every time an NYPD car would pull up behind me, I would reach down alongside my seat and pull out that .45 and tuck it under my leg, because if those guys are going to arrest me for murder, I'm going to make them shoot me. I can't go to, I'm not prison material. I can't do that. I say 12 days because on the 12th day, there was a notice put in the newspaper that they did make an arrest in that murder, and they had all kinds of evidence. They went to this guy's house at they found all of his bloody jeans tucked down in the laundry basket, and yeah, everything matched. And so I breathed a huge sigh of relief. I mean, can you imagine, 19 years old, and I haven't even begun to go into half of the screwy circumstances that happened in those years leading up. But how do you navigate in your mind at 19 years old that I might have done this? And so I breathed a huge sigh of relief, but I was smart enough to know, As whacked out as I was smart enough to know, thank holy shit, it wasn't me this time. It wasn't me this time. What about next time? Because it's going to happen again. And so I worked with a guy, Big Tom. The funeral directors referred to Big Tom as Lurch. Where's Lurch? Because he looked like Lurch. Remember Lurch from the Addams Family? He'd answer the door and it goes, you rang, right? He looked like Lurch. He was not an attractive guy in any way, shape, or form, you know. But Tom was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. It was the only thing I had ever heard about Alcoholics Anonymous was Big Tom was in it. That's it. His car had less dents than mine. People didn't give him a hard time. I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. And so, you know, when you get asked to speak in AA, they want you to, and our literature says, we share in a general way what it used to be like, and it is you, me, what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. The what happened part is the part that people tend to want to glaze over real quick. But that what happened part, that's the important part. And so what happened for me is I came to on a Saturday morning when I was supposed to have been at work, and I couldn't lose that job. I mean, I can't get any other job. I can't have job interviews. I can't carry on a conversation if I pause, like I do from time to time, completely forget what I was talking about, end of conversation. That's it. Can't get a job when you can't talk. Can't get a job when you can't read and comprehend. And so I can't lose the job in the cemetery. So for me, not going to work was a big thing. I came to at about 11 o'clock in the morning, the same way I would come to many, many times, scared shitless, and not at all recognizing anything around me. Where the hell am I now? And I would be sometimes I was in the park, sometimes I was in the cemetery because I would sleep up there, and sometimes I was in my own room at my parents' house still. And this one, I was in my own room, but it took me almost a full minute to recognize where the hell I was. And then I realized, oh my God, I was supposed to be at work. But the intuitive thought that was given to me was, you need to go talk to Big Tom. And you know where he is right now. It's 11, going on noon. Tom eats his lunch every single day at the Corner House Bar and Grill. Now, it didn't ever dawn on me, why would a guy, Tom, who had 10 years of sobriety at that time, be eating his lunch in a bar every day? That was too much of a complex thought for me at the time. I didn't care about that. But I knew where he was going to be. And so I went up to the Corner House, which I had worked in briefly. There he was, sitting down at the end of the bar, talking to Tom H., the owner, and Pete Sherry, the bartender. And so I went over and I got to talking with Tommy and I said, you still go to those meetings? And we got to talking a little bit. And interesting that Tom H. and Pete Sherry, their ears kind of perked up. What I didn't know, what I had no idea at the time, was that Big Tom, with 10 years of sobriety, was the youngest sober guy in that corner. The owner of the bar, Tom H., had 17 years of sobriety, and Pete Sherry had 21 years of sobriety at that time. And he was the bartender. He came from a whole family of bartenders. That's what his family did. And so I was surrounded by AA guys in the corner of this bar, and I had no idea. And Tom, true to his word, brought me to my very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, you would think after that incident in August of 1980, where I was afraid that I had killed this girl, that would have been 3 months later. It wasn't until November of 1980 that I made my very, November 23rd, 1980, I made my very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Big Tom met me at the door, and he introduced me to a bunch of old, crusty guys in the back of the room. A lot like what I am right now. Old, crusty guy. And they were the group of guys that, if you didn't have anything good to say, come sit with us. But they were kind of rough guys, you know? Richie W. still ran numbers for the mob, but he was sober, and he's sitting in the back of that room. And Richie and Al, the Polish princes, that's what we referred to them as, the Polish princes. And all of these crusty old guys in the back, and who put their arm around me and shook my hand and said, you keep coming here. Where are you going? Listen, here's a meeting list. We got a meeting tomorrow night at this church. Be there. And a little poke in the chest, be there. And so I'm a little intimidated by these guys. I'm thinking if I don't show up, they're going to come find me, you know. And so that started my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. At that time, I was just talking with Mike that in those years, if anybody in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous said anything about anything other than alcohol, if you started to talk about pot or you started to talk about anything else, these old guys would jump right down your throat and go, we don't talk about that here. And so if anybody said, don't smoke pot, I didn't hear that. I tried staying sober for the first 90 days on a marijuana maintenance program. And I'm going to tell you, it don't work. It don't work. For me, it don't work. What's dicey now is that we have, like, doctors and cards and, you know, dispensaries everywhere. But it is my opinion, oh, solely my opinion, that apart from prescription medications, if you're taking anything that affects you from the neck up, if I take anything that affects me from the neck up that is not a prescription medication, I'm not sober. And so I don't do that. And so I don't even remember going to the bar. I don't even remember ordering the drink. I don't even remember any of that. What I do know is that I came out of a blackout yet again, and all of that internal in my brain horror was back. And so I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous and I dove in. I just immersed myself in this program. If I wasn't at work and I wasn't sleeping in my house, I was at a meeting somewhere. I met wonderful, wonderful people, man, just incredible people. I was just talking with my oldest and dearest friend, Greg, several days ago. I'm going to fly in, and I go in every year for a men's retreat in New York, and I'm going to go in the end of May. I'm going to stay at Greg's house, and then the two of us will drive to the retreat house. Greg, I met Greg in my very early sobriety, and so if you're new here, one of the best things that I could tell you to do is find your tribe. Find your tribe. Make friends. Because until you can really grasp what being sober and what the 12 steps, which are a design for living, they are a way of life, until those things really start to take root, your friends will help keep you sober. Lean on them. It's not a foolproof thing, but it's a way to start. And so, Greg said to me the other day, he goes, do you realize that we got sober in the most retarded version of AA on the North Shore of Staten Island? And I said, yeah, I do. I recognize that now. I didn't know it then, but I certainly see it now. It wasn't until some time went by that I got away from the North Shore of Staten Island and started going to meetings in other areas that I discovered I met people. I met friends. I met a guy by the name of Dennis. Wonderful, wonderful guy. Holy cow. Who taught me, he had so much patience, and taught me that the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are a way to live, and this is how you live these steps every single day, to the very best of your ability. I had a real serious problem with the concept of God, and Dennis just simplified that for me. I was really frightened that I had gone too far in the other direction. I remember in my very early being sober, within the first couple of weeks, that I came to one morning, having not had a drink for about 2 weeks, and there was something next to my ear that was growling and laughing at the same time. And that's how I woke up, you know. I had a lot of darkness. There was a lot of dark shit going on upstairs. Dennis, very gently, erased all of that for me just by his words. And I couldn't even tell you today the things that he said to me, but he simplified the concept of God so much that my warped and retarded brain was able to comprehend that. It was able to absorb his understanding of God. And the willingness to do that was the only thing that was necessary. The door opened up. It opened up just a little bit. And the sun started to shine through, man. This thing was starting to work. That life was starting to get better. I was starting to get better. I was probably about a year sober at that time when all that was going on. I woke up one day, and the radio was on, and there was an advertisement to go skydiving down in South New Jersey. And so I called up the one guy that I kind of thought was crazy enough to do this with me, Crazy Kenny. And I said, Kenny, you want to go jump out of an airplane? He goes, yeah. And so we piled into my car, and we drove down to South Jersey, and we signed every release form that they had. You couldn't sue them for anything. And we climbed into this little 4 hours of ground training on how to land, and we climbed into this little Cessna airplane, I only had one seat, and that was for the pilot. The rest of us were sitting on the floor. It's taken off down the runway, and I'm like, oh my God, this is incredible. I am totally getting off on how much power and thrust behind the engine of this plane. And off we go, and I'm looking down, and the houses are all getting smaller, and the cars on the Jersey Turnpike are getting smaller, and everything is, this is incredible. And then they open the door, right? And that's when it struck me that I'd never been in a plane before. I'm not the sharpest tack in the board here. But I looked around, and nobody was looking at me. And these words just came. They came to me. Nobody was looking at me. And so I quick did this, made the sign of the cross, because I thought that's what you had to do to get God's attention. You know? And I said, the words that came to me were this. God, if I jump out of this airplane and my chute opens up and I have a wonderful time, thank you. And immediately after that, I said, God, if I jump out of this airplane and my chute doesn't open at all and I splatter into the ground and today is my last day, thank you. And I thought that it really had an effect on me, because in that first year of my sobriety, I was able to make amends to my parents. All of those times when I came home at 3-4 o'clock in the morning, my mom was still awake in the living room crying, that I would get so angry with her. Why? You know, don't do this to me. You know I'm going to be fine. And in my incredible selfishness, not even realizing that maybe the reason why she's crying is not because her youngest son is still out there running amok. It's because her husband, my father, was going through cancer treatments at the time. You know? And I would get angry with her for that. And so that first year of sobriety, where I made that living amends and continued to make that living amends to my parents, that if God decided today's your last day, that 1 year was worth it. Still here, you know. I landed, not gracefully, but I landed, you know. And then like 30 or 45 minutes later, I remembered to go, oh, thank you, you know. I told that story to my old brother-in-law, Craig. Craig was a great guy in San Diego, sober 17 years. He had developed a terrible cancer, very aggressive cancer. He was only in his early 40s. One of the last times I went to go see him was in Thornton Hospital in San Diego, over by the Scripps system, and was sitting at his hospital room, and he's sitting up in bed, and he's so skinny. He's so skinny and shot out. And Craig said, you know that story about skydiving? I said, yeah. He goes, I say that prayer every time I come in one of these places. That if I get to come out of here, thank you. But if I don't ever leave the inside of this room ever again, thank you. And so it was very touching to me that he took that stupid story about jumping out of an airplane and relate it so seriously to his life at that time. I'm the second person, thank you Alcoholics Anonymous, I am the second person in my family to ever go to college. I told you I navigated 12 years in the New York City public school system completely unscarred by education. But I watched guys in Alcoholics Anonymous and I listened to Dennis, who would tell me, you know, you can't be too stupid to stay sober here and live this program, to understand those 12 steps and assimilate them into your life every single day. You cannot be too dumb to do that, but you can certainly be too smart. And so he encouraged me to go to school, and I did. I went to school in Manhattan for something completely unrelated. It took me about a year, and about 85% of the people who take this course and do the practical exam fail the practical exam. This was for stationary engineering. I was going to get on with the New York City Fire Department like my dad after I'd gotten sober. I was the last one in my family to have the ability to do that. And so I did take the test for New York City Fire. I scored they do it differently back there. They put out a message in the civil service newspaper, and 35,000 people come out and get an application, you know. And you take the written exam, and then you take the physical exam, and between those two, I scored a 93%, which you would think is not bad. No, number 13,421. I ain't getting on the job, you know. And so I ended up going to school for stationary engineering. It's a year-long school. And a practical exam at the end, 85% of the people failed that thing. I passed it the first time. And so what I learned out of that is that I'm not stupid. I can retain book knowledge, and I can stay dedicated and persevere my way through these classes. Why did I learn that? I learned it because I watched people in Alcoholics Anonymous do it. I watched friends of mine go do school and be successful. And if they can do it, I can do it. It's the same concept as if I can stay sober, you can stay sober. I did that. And then one of the things that I always, you know, I would sit on a bar years earlier and look out the picture window and think, someday I'm going to go skiing, and someday I'm going to go skydiving, and someday I'm going to go cross country. I'm going to drive cross country like my oldest brother did. And I want to do all those things, but I wasn't getting off the bar stool to do anything at all. I didn't do any of those things until I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I say it all the time in meetings that I really do feel like my life started. It started when I came to AA. That's when my life really started. I traveled cross country. I ended up coming to San Diego. I knew three people in San Diego. This was in 1985. I'd been sober just under 5 years. So in 1986, I celebrated my fifth year of sobriety in San Diego, and I was touring the country. I was going to tour the country for a year and then go back to New York and retest for New York Fire, and then I would get on. And I ended up meeting a girl in San Diego, and you know, you girls always screw up our plans. And so... So that relation, I decided to stick around to see where that relationship was going to go. And, we ended up getting married, and we had a couple of kids, and I never wanted to work for any other fire department, so I took a completely different route. If I was successful in going to school for the stationary engineering thing in New York City, well, then maybe I need to go to college. And so I became the second person in my family to ever go to college. And the result of that... was that I graduated as a registered nurse. It's very interesting how you can go from gravedigger to RN. If you're looking for the link, there's a whole anatomy link there, you know, like bones, look, bones. So I became a registered nurse. I was 10 years sober when I started nursing school. My very first semester ended, I took my finals, and then I immediately got on a plane and flew back to New York because my dad was dying. His cancer had come back, and he and I had wonderful conversation, man. I was sitting at the foot of his bed, just kind of laying across the foot of his bed, and he and I just shooting shit. And he said that he was proud of me. That he was proud of all of us, the four of us. All of the kids. He said, I'm really very happy with how all of you guys have turned out, and I don't worry about you. So how do you express gratitude to Alcoholics Anonymous? Not only did it preserve a physical life, it gave me an actual life. It gave me my understanding of God, which I have leaned on immensely over the years. I had no way of knowing, you know, let me finish that thought. What Alcoholics Anonymous gave my family is it gave my parents the ability to die peacefully, not worried about their youngest son and where he is and what he's doing. So thank you, AA, for that. I had no idea there's no way. How could you possibly make amends to countless anonymous people that you did damage to out there? wrecking their property, purposely wrecking their vehicles, and purposely wrecking their just doing damage, scaring them, purposely scaring them. How do you go back and make amends to countless anonymous people? And what did God do for me? I didn't plan on going to college to become a registered nurse. I didn't plan on pursuing that career. It presented itself to me and it made sense. And so I pursued it. And I spent almost 30 years in that job, almost 30 years in that career. My very first job was in critical care in Bakersfield, and then I moved into open heart recovery, and then I moved into operating room, and then I became a flight nurse for a local fire department that had an air ambulance helicopter. And then concurrently, I went to work for a company just up north here that was a fixed-wing aircraft, medical transport aircraft, and we would do interfacility transfers from little small local hospitals to larger hospitals that had more services. But the helicopter job, that was the one that really was the one that I wanted to do. I spent all those years working in the hospital, working in emergency rooms, working in critical care to hone my skills so that I could do that. And every day that we would climb into that helicopter, I knew this thing has 8,000 whirling parts that any of them going badly could put us down into the ground in a smoking hole in the desert, you know. Flight suit's gonna look good, but there ain't nothing else left, right? And I thought to myself, this is how, what did God do for me? God allowed me to make amends to countless anonymous people at the worst times of their life. How could I make it better? And so it made up for all of those years and all of that damage I did back in New York by making amends to countless anonymous people who were having a terrible freaking day, like a really bad day. There's a real brief memory of a guy that went head on his motorcycle. He went head on into a truck. And amazingly, the guy was still awake and alert. He was messed up, but he was awake and alert. And there was really, at that point, no need to intubate him or chemically induce him down into unconsciousness. We were flying him to a trauma center. And the guy was trying to talk to me, and it was very loud inside the aircraft. And so I leaned over with my little microphone in front of me so that he could speak into the microphone and I could hear him. And he said, "I'm so effing scared." And the only thing I could tell this guy, apart from everything that we were doing for him medically, the only thing I could tell this guy was I leaned over next to his ear and I said, "I'm not gonna let you die here." And I don't know if I had any right to say that because, you know, that decision ain't up to me. My responsibility is to act correctly using my knowledge, my education, and my experience to try and intervene in this guy's life and in all of these people's lives. And we did keep him alive. Till we got to the trauma center, and then he died. And so there's just countless stories like that, more than I can even begin to relay to people. These are memories. These are memories that roll around in my head, and I love them. I hate getting emotional up here, I really do. I hate it. But this life in sobriety, this life that God has given us, the ability to interact in each other's lives, we keep each other alive. We encourage each other to stay sober. We encourage each other to seek out God, to live these steps to the very best of our ability, because that's how we stay alive. And holy cow, we did that countdown last night. Wayne mentioned it. There's a lot of sobriety in this room. There is a lot of sobriety in this room. To think about the ripple effect that your sobriety, that my sobriety has had, just like when we're out there drinking, the ripple effect of how we selfishly, self-centeredly live that existence out there affects so many people, destroys so many things. And inversely, what happens here, the ripple effect of what happens here just goes out and affects so many lives. I got two kids that have never seen their father drunk. Never. I have an ex-wife who's never seen her ex-husband drunk, ever. There's no animosity between me and her. She lives on the other side of the country. I'm grateful for that, too. You know. I really wanted to start, I really kind of contemplated starting my pitch here today with, we live in Tehachapi. And we were driving up here. It's only an hour and a half drive, you know, and I'm just kind of keeping up with the flow of traffic along the 14. But I looked in the side view mirror, and here comes those flashing blue and red lights, the ones you never want to see behind you. And I thought, man, that guy's coming up fast. I better speed up. And so, I don't want to get in his way. But interesting, I made a lane change, he made a lane change, and I changed back, and he changed back. And I'm like, finally, what the hell with this guy? And so I finally just pulled over. And he got out of that car, man, and that guy was just mad. He came up to my window, and he said, "You give me one good reason why I'm just haul you off to jail right now." And I said, "Well, sir, years ago, my first wife left me for a CHP officer." And he said, "So?" And I said, "So I got scared. I thought you were bringing her back." There's no truth to that story. It's an honest program, right? There's no truth to that story at all, except the fact that I do have an ex-wife, you know? And so Alcoholics Anonymous and sobriety. This is a sobriety that works through good times and through bad times. It works in all times. And it's been my experience that I don't truly learn to trust God until I reach those times of overwhelming concern. It's only going through sober, going through challenging times that I truly learned to trust God. That divorce that I went through was a terrible, challenging time for me. What I learned out of that was to trust God. That my story is not over. It's not over until He says it's over. And so I get to keep putting one foot in front of the other and trying to positively affect every life that I encounter. I say a prayer every morning. God, thank you for today. Thank you for my sobriety today. Thank you for all the wonderful people, places, and things that you've placed in my life. Thank you for all the people, places, and things that you have removed from my life. Please take away from me every single negative thing in my personality that stops me from being a kind, gentle, and loving human being to every living thing that I encounter. And yet, I stumble with that from time to time. I stumbled last night, sitting right here, this back table. I said something I shouldn't have said. In 2019, that was an interesting year for me. 2019, I'm going to wrap this up here pretty soon. My time is almost up. In 2019, I was working for the last 16 years. Once that helicopter job shut down, I needed a job. I was still working for up in Bishop, flying with that company up there. But I needed a steady full-time job, and the prison was hiring, and so I went to work for the state of California in a maximum security prison as an RN, doing nighttime emergency response. 6,000 inmates, two nurses. That's it. And so it was interesting. We had a lot of interesting events, as you can imagine, in a prison. Spent the last 16 years of my career working in that joint. And 2019, I met, shocking to me, I met the love of my life. It was her birthday. She was a friend of mine. We worked together. I knew that it was her birthday, and so and she was going out. I knew she had a date, and I thought, just text her, happy birthday. And so we started texting back and forth and found out that her date was already over. And I thought, oh, okay. And so I went over to see her. And we have been together every day ever since. She is my wife now. I coming out of a situation where I said I was never, ever getting married again. You know, God's got amazing plans. And keep an open mind. Just keep an open mind, right? 2019 is also the time when I had gotten some funky lab results back. And in early 2020, I got diagnosed with cancer. And so 5 months later, I was on the operating table having surgery to get rid of this cancer, 5.5 hours on the table. I've never been a patient before. I've always been the provider, but I've never been a patient. We had to go through all the testing before that and biopsies and things and miscellaneous things where they had to put me to sleep. And I was really kind of concerned that when I would come out of anesthesia, what am I going to say? I've done conscious sedation on patients. I've done a shit ton of that. And so I know people get to talking and they have no memory of what they're saying. So you kind of get the true story out of them, right? And so I was a little concerned about, what the hell am I going to say? You know? Three times under anesthesia? And Angela was able to be right there when they were waking me up. And what I'm told is that as I was waking up, what I was saying, I was told what I was saying. I was really kind of concerned because I come from kind of a harsh background. And I was afraid that that harshness was going to come through and from my subconscious. Get your effing hands off me or something like that. And what I found out is that what was coming out of my mouth was all love and gratitude. I was telling these nurses that were recovering me, I love you guys. Thank you guys for everything that you do. You see that girl right there? I spilled the beans. This is bad because I had no memory that I said this. But I said, you see that girl? Isn't that she beautiful? She's so beautiful. I'm going to marry her. Spilled the beans, right? So three times like that. I was really kind of concerned about what I was going to say, but what came out was love and gratitude. And so what that means is we talk about having a spiritual experience. We talk about having a spiritual awakening. We talk about having a psychic change and a personality change. And that is exactly what has happened with me. I have had that psychic change. I no longer see people as enemies. I no longer see them as adversaries. I see brothers and sisters. That's what I see, and that's what I feel. I'm terribly embarrassed. Sometimes that's not how I live. Sometimes I mess it up. But when I can identify my defects of character, when I can actively try to live the opposite of whatever that defect is, God will grace me with the reduction of that defect of character. To the degree that I'm putting in effort is the degree that it will get removed. And so my cancer surgery was successful. I am cancer-free. And it was an aggressive cancer. About 8-9 months ago, I had a full knee replacement done. I didn't know that retirement was going to involve replacement parts. And I climbed those stairs, right? So it's been interesting. It's been an interesting life. We have between the two of us 6 kids, 4 grandkids. With 1 on the way. Gonna be another boy. And
And we have kids who are wonderful, wonderful human beings. Four of them, all because of her. Two of them, because of me and Alcoholics Anonymous. I love you guys. Who was it that read the daily reflections? Carrie. So true. So absolutely true. To see a life built up around you like that. It is something that, thank God, I have not missed it. And I thank God every day that I continue to see it. You guys have been wonderful here. I want to thank you so much for allowing me to come up and speak. I had no idea what the hell I was going to say. I think it was Barbara that said, boy, I can't wait to hear what you're going to say. I said, me too. You know. Thank you guys so much for this experience. I love you all. And God bless you. Another 24 hours of sobriety. I can't describe God to you, but I know it when I see it. Thank you guys so much. All right.